Now I'd like to welcome Dr. Geeshan as our first speaker this morning, leading off the exegetical symposium, my very congenial colleague. Dr. Charles Geeshan is an assistant professor of exegetical theology and the chairman of the Department of Exegetical Theology at Concordia Seminary. He prepared for the pastoral office at Fort Wayne, gaining his MDiv in 1984, and then did graduate work at Princeton Theological Seminary, gaining the THM in New Testament in 1985, followed by studies at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, in Michigan, where he gained the PhD in Near Eastern Studies in 1995. He served as associate pastor and then senior pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church, Traverse City, Michigan, from 1985 through 1996. During a six-month sabbatical from his parish in 1994, he was a student at the University of Oxford in England. Several of his articles have been published in scholarly journals, and a revision of his doctoral dissertation entitled Angulomorphic Christology, Antecedents and Early Evidence was published in 1998 by Brill Academic Press. Dr. Geeshan and his wife Christy have been blessed with two children, Stefan and Lauren. Please welcome Dr. Geeshan.
Just to put aside any fears, this paper is not a commentary on the relationship between modern cinema and the Book of Revelation. I think by the end of the paper you'll see why I used the film about going deep into the Vietnam jungles, which was that film was entitled Apocalypse Now, while I used that title. Secondly, some of you will recognize echoes from last year's paper, since I'm a firm advocate of continuing revelation. I'm just picking up where I left off when I ran out of time last year. So the paper is entitled Apocalypse Now, subtitled Inaugurated Eschatology in the Book of Revelation. You should have a handout which has several texts on it, and a second handout that has a chart on it. If you don't, those are available and are helpful as we walk through this text. There's a widespread belief that the opening three chapters of the book of Revelation speak about the present reality of John and the original hearers, while the remaining chapters, namely 4 verse 1 to 22 verse 6, are a series of visions of future reality. To put it simply, these visions are understood to be pictures of the future rather than the past or the present. When I'm saying that, I'm not saying that's necessarily a widespread pastoral or scholarly understanding, but certainly in a wider Christian society. This understanding grows primarily from the misconception that Jewish and Christian apocalyptic literature, including Revelation, is totally about eschatology or the end times. The adjectives apocalyptic and eschatological have become virtually synonymous in modern English usage. Just a little aside, I think that movie would have been better titled Eschaton Now, but that didn't communicate or sell as well as Apocalypse Now. It is also founded upon the mistaken impression that the repeated literary markers in Revelation concerning the things that must take place soon apply to all the visions that John sees and records. If anything in Revelation is understood to be depicting the past or the present, it is because those visions have been realized or are being realized since the time of the author's experience, namely in our past and present. Furthermore, even if people see some of the content of Revelation realized or being realized in the present day, there still is a tendency to emphasize that the bulk of Revelation, the book of Revelation, remains to be realized in the days ahead. In short, future eschatology often dominates discussions of Revelation. In distinction to this view, this paper will demonstrate that the dominant content of Revelation is the revealing of present reality for the author, a reality that is ongoing and present also for the church to now, especially in the worship context of the divine service. It will be shown that the central vision of Revelation, the throne room scene of chapters 4 and 5, is not depicting a future event, but a past, present, and eternal reality that is foundational for understanding all present and future events. Unlike much Second Temple Jewish apocalyptic literature that depicts a future deliverance at the end of time, Revelation emphasizes the inauguration and presence of the end time deliverance. It will also be shown that the content of the various visions in the cycles of sevens was understood as a ready coming into being for John and his congregations, even as he was receiving these visions. This examination will proceed along three lines. First, the linguistic markers in Revelation will be examined for what they tell us about the time frame of the visions that John records. Second, the structure and content of the particular particular visions will be examined in order to determine the eschatology presented in them. Third, the relationship between worship and inaugurated eschatology will be examined. As you can see, a rather ambitious project for 9 o'clock in the morning after driving a few hours, at least for some of you. It will be clear that Revelation is dominated by inaugurated eschatology, or content about the presence now of what was expected at the end. It is often an apocalypse or a revelation of what exists now in the present. Therefore, it has significant application for the life or to the life of the church in each age, even now as we enter a new millennium of the Christian era. Part 1, inaugurated eschatology and the literary time markers of Revelation. The most significant literary marker of time in Revelation is the phrase ha dai genesthai en tachai, the things that must take place soon. It's found twice, once at the beginning of the document and again at the end. See text 1 and 2 on your handout. You see, first of all, the opening verse, the apocalypse of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants the things that must take place soon. And then again at the end of the apocalypse is a frame at the end. And he said to me, these words are faithful and true, and the Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show to his servants the things that must take place soon. These two literary time markers frame the entire document and lead some interpreters to the conclusion that the contents of everything between them is future with respect to the seer, John, his place in history. Namely, he is being shown things that will take place at some soon-to-happen future time. Such an understanding puts the latter days as a reality that will dawn in the future. The theological significance of this phrase, however, cannot be fully understood unless we see the close relationship of these two literary markers with the Septuagint text of Daniel chapter 2, verses 28 to 29. Notice text 3 on your handout. There is, however, a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar the things that must take place in the latter days. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the latter days, and the one who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. Both the significance of Daniel for recording the content of Revelation and the close vocabulary correspondence between these three texts. Note the ha dai genesthai, the things that must take place, indicate a virtually certain genealogical relationship between Daniel 2:28 and 2:29 and the phrases in Revelation 1 and 22. Namely, John, as he records this vision, draws on the very language of Daniel. There is a very significant difference, however, in eschatological perspective. Daniel speaks of things that must take place in the latter days, while Revelation speaks of the things that must take place soon. The shift in adapting the language of Daniel as he recorded his visions shows that the seer John understood the things described in Daniel as happening in the latter days to be the very things that he now saw in the visions and as happening soon. This literary marker indicates that John understood that the latter days had dawned, that they were inaugurated in Jesus Christ. Rather than looking forward into the mysteries that were to take place in the latter days, as found in Daniel, the seer John found himself in the midst of the latter days as these mysteries were unfolding. This eschatological perspective is also present in Revelation 1:3, text 4 on your handout. Notice, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed the things that are written, for the time is near. Gregory Beale notes that the phrase at the end of this text, for the time is near, may be taken, and I quote, as an exaggerated expression of imminence. The time is not simply coming soon, but is actually here. In this respect, it resembles the inaugurated eschatology found in the announcement of the nearness of the kingdom of God by John the Baptist and Jesus, especially visible in Mark 1:15 and Luke 21:8. Some 30 years after the king slipped into this world to reclaim his kingdom from the ruler of this world, the kingdom of God not only was near, but inaugurated and present in the flesh and blood Jesus. In like manner, the recognition in Revelation 1:3 that the time is near is signaling the hearers that the time is here, even though the final consummation is yet to come. There are two other literary time markers in Revelation 1:19 and 4:1, text 5 and 6 in your outline. Notice there the language is the things that are and the things that are to take place after these things. That's 1:19. And then in 4:1, a little bit later in the Apocalypse, to show you the things that must take place after these things. Some interpreters understand Revelation 1:19 to be a linear scheme for the book. John is to write down what he has seen, the vision of Christ in chapter 1, which he has just received, the things that are, those are seen as the current state of the church that is depicted in the seven letters given in chapters 2 and 3, and the things that must take place after these things, that being the visions found in chapters 4 through 22 of Revelation. Such an understanding views the material in 4 to 22 as future. A much preferable alternative to this interpretation is simply to understand the command to write in 1:19 as a reiteration of the command to write in 1:11, where John hears, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches. If this be the case, then the second chi, or translated and, in 1:19 should be interpreted epexegetically as specifying two basic categories of things which John is to record. Namely, my translation would be, write therefore the things that you see, chi, namely the things that are and the things that are about to take place after these things. This interpretation indicates that some of the contents of 4 through 22, chapters 4 to 22, depict things in John's present time, while others depict future things and final consummation. Furthermore, these two texts are also related to Daniel 2:28 to 29. It's noteworthy that one of the versions of the Greek Old Testament even uses the phrase metatauta in translating some of the Hebrew text of Daniel, and I give you some examples. So that the change of using the phrase metatauta after these things may even, that too, may be linked to the traditions that one has and finds in Daniel. Therefore, it is clear, hopefully, after this brief discussion, that these four literary markers convey the sense that the latter days spoken of in Daniel have dawned, and that the visions in Revelation speak about both present and future things relative to the seer John. Part 2, inaugurated eschatology in the structure of Revelation. Any discussion of the detailed structure of Revelation is beset with problems. This is clear from the fact that there is very little agreement among very learned scholars who have studied the issue. There is, however, increasing recognition that Revelation is far from a haphazard recording of disconnected visions. It is rather a very carefully organized book. And namely, not only is the vision have coherence, but as John recorded it, he recorded it in a very careful way, because it's full of literary markers that are repeated for the sake of the hearer and take on additional significance for the one who repeatedly hears or reads and studies the document in detail. And I just call to your attention the book by Richard Balcom. I have it listed on the back side of the handout, The Climax of Prophecy. Actually, I think I've listed it as The Climax of Revelation. It's the book is called The Climax of Prophecy. Please correct that. And in that opening chapter of that book is a very helpful article on the structure of Revelation. It will certainly increase your appreciation for the John's literary artistry as he recorded these visions that he received. Furthermore, there is some agreement on the basic structure of the book. This basic structure will provide us with some clear direction to where inaugurated eschatology is depicted in Revelation. The book as a whole was meant to be carried to and read by the church. Thus, the visionary content is set in the context of an epistle. This is clear from the epistolary greeting already in the opening verses, verses 4 to 6 of the opening chapter, and the epistolary conclusion in chapter 22, verse 6. These epistolary markers are found to be in a short prologue, first 8 verses of chapter 1, and respectively in the epilogue, the last few verses of chapter 22, 6 through 21 of that chapter. The rest of the book consists of a single visionary experience with certainly many transitions that began with John when he was in the Spirit, chapter 1, verse 10, with a vision of Christ delivering the seven letters. And it continues through three major transition points as it progresses, each marked by the phrase, in the Spirit, in chapter 4, verse 2, 17, 3, and 21, 10. See the text listed under 8. The vision of Babylon that begins at 17, 3 clearly ends at 19, 10, and is followed by a transition section concerning judgment before the parallel vision of the New Jerusalem begins at chapter 21:10. The judgment scene is transitional because the vision of Babylon and the vision of the New Jerusalem have parallel introductions and conclusions that mark them off as literary units that function together and in contrast. Therefore, the basic structure of Revelation is as follows, and look at this under number 9 in your outline. And we'll be walking through this a bit, so you can just keep that before you as we continue our discussion. The question before us now is this. What is the eschatological perspective of the visions between the prologue and the epilogue? first vision of the Son of Man dictating the seven letters is the easiest to discern. It's a portrait of present reality. The vision, though, does reflect inaugurated eschatology because the end-time Danielic, one like a Son of Man, is depicted as a present reality, as a glorified one. Christ is the Son of Man who has already conquered, who has already been enthroned, and now has the keys to death and Hades. There is little disagreement concerning the eschatology of this vision. The vision of the divine throne and the series of sevens that comes next, chapters 4 through 16, is often seen as the place where the visions shift to a reality that's future relative to John. Although such a shift to the future occurs in many of the series of sevens, this shift does not happen in the vision of the divine throne of chapters 4 and 5. Leonard Thompson states, following the cue of the voice, we expect visions of eschatological events, that is, of things to come. Instead, the seer sees worship around the throne of God in heaven. At several later points in Revelation, eschatological expectations will be met in the same way by scenes of present heavenly worship. The vision of the divine throne is not depicting a future event, but a reality that is past, that is present, that is eternal. It is past because it anchors this enthronement of the Lamb with the crucifixion and resurrection. The Paschal Lamb that had been slaughtered was now standing, and the saints sing, "You are worthy, for you were slain, and by your blood you did ransom men for God." 5:9. In one sense, John saw happening right before his eyes in the mysteries of heaven something that had already taken place in time. The enthronement of the Lamb was certainly not delayed for decades after the resurrection to occur somehow in this vision to John while he was at Patmos. This understanding is confirmed by the fact that one of the seven letters before the enthronement, the depiction of the enthronement of the Lamb scene, in one of those letters, Jesus acknowledges his enthronement as a present reality. Text 10 on your outline. To the one who conquers, I will give a place with me on my throne, just as I myself conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne. This is certainly full two chapters before John sees the enthronement of the Lamb, chapter 5. Furthermore, this vision is also depicting present and eternal reality because the enthronement and worship of God and the Lamb continues in John's day, our day, and beyond time into eternity. This is clear from the worship scenes that recur as the apocalypse moves forward. Eric Peterson poignantly contrasts the eternal perspective of this vision with the eschatology that follows the throne room vision. And I quote here, it's a wonderful quote from his book, The Liturgy and the Angels. More urgent than any announcement of eschatological events is the account of the vision of the heavenly throne room and the heavenly worship of God. In other words, the eschatological events which the seer beholds are undoubtedly important, but in contrast to all the eschatological world events, and supreme is the everlasting God, whoever was and is still to come, and who is unceasingly glorified by angels in an eternal world. Through all the pain of this world, throughout all the changes and demonic battles of our epoch, there remains, eternal and unmoved, that worship which the angels offer to the eternal, and in which the church on earth takes part. As with the depiction of the throne in Ezekiel 1, and certainly, I mean, there's no more important book for Revelation and understanding it than the apocalyptic, the prophetic book Ezekiel. As with the depiction of the throne in Ezekiel 1, the dominant vision in most Jewish apocalypses is the revelation of the presence of God on his throne. That vision isn't just one of several. That is the central vision in these apocalypses, the vision often around which other scenes revolve. The vision of the throne in Revelation is not one vision along a linear progression of equally important visions. It is the dominant and defining reality of the apocalypse. And too often, we just read 4 and 5 and go on to others, and we don't keep the central significance of 4 and 5 before us as we read on. So the scene in 4 and 5, Revelation 4 and 5, is not a temporary vision among many other equally important visions. It depicts the eternal reality of worship centered on God and the Lamb that remains constant through all the changing seasons of life that are depicted in chapters 6 through 16 of Revelation. Far from escaping reality, here God unveils the totality of reality so that it defines the seer's and hearer's understanding of God and his universe. The message of this throne vision is unmistakable. God is reigning and has entrusted the victorious Lamb with the control of the rest of history as it moves to the final judgment and deliverance. In contrast to many Jewish apocalypses that point people to a future end-time deliverance, Revelation testifies to a strongly inaugurated eschatology. The deliverer and deliverance expected at the end of time has come in time and is present now. Leonard Thompson states, "But the Lamb Lion who conquers by his death belongs not solely in the eschatological drama. He belongs as well in the world's present structure as revealed in the scenes of heavenly worship. Thus, the kingdom of God and the rule of the Messiah, future eschatological claims, are acclaimed in heavenly liturgies as present eternal realities." End of quote. Thus, the present and future chaos of sin on earth, which is depicted in chapters 6 through 16, must be seen in light of the present and eternal reign of God and the Lamb over all of the cosmos. A discussion of the relationship between worship and inaugurated eschatology is so important, we're going to come back to it and devote section 3 of this paper to it. The structure of eschatology found in the scenes which follow, now we're moving on from 4 and 5 to 6 through 16, are much more difficult to explain. The most obvious literary markers of this section are 3 series of 7 judgments that are explicitly numbered so that the hearers see the progression of the vision through the opening of the 7 seals, the blowing of 7 trumpets, and the pouring out of 7 bowls. And here you see the chart, the other handout, which lays out for you those 3. All 3 cycles of 7s are grouped in 4 and 3, and the first two have a distinct interlude before the 7th part of the series comes, in a sense giving some tension to the fact of the arrival of the end time. But all of them, in a sense, are they're not 7, 7, 7 in a linear progression, but 7, 7, 7 covering a similar time period, just that each series you get an increased expectation of the end of time coming when you arrive at the 7th in the series. The throne scene from which these series of 7s commence is also where they conclude. To put it another way, the divine throne is both the starting point for this judgment activity, namely the first series is the 7 seals. It flows right out of the fact that the Lamb has been given the book and begins to peel the seals from the scroll. To put it another way, the divine throne is both the starting point for this judgment activity and the final goal to which this activity is progressing, the presence of God at the end. This is clear in each of these three series as it ends with mention of characteristics used in the description of the throne room. And I, under text 11, I have four examples. The first one obviously being from the throne room scene, Revelation 4. But then at the end of each of the series of sevens, you have similar theophanic, namely similar characteristics of the theophany in the throne room, so that links you back in with the presence of God, worship, and the divine throne. Interludes in these three series of seven often depict past, present, and future events collapsed into a vision. I'll give you two examples. So here you can see that even within these series of seven, certainly which are broad portraits that are given, you have some content that is speaking about past and present events relative to John. The first is the sealing of the saints, and the second is the expulsion of Satan from heaven, sealing of the saints, chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. That's text 12. You look at it, you see there the emphasis is on sealing those people to protect them from any kind of harm as these events unfold that are being described in the seven seals. Last year at this symposia, I explained that this scene was understood in the early church as a vision of what happens in holy baptism over generations of time as people are sealed with the divine name. All of us know that there has been generation after generation of Christians who have been reborn in baptism, have experienced the chaos of this fallen world as described in John's visions, and then have died in the faith. The book of Revelation does not give multiple individual visions of these Christians, but one encompassing vision that depicts the sealing of the church of all generations with the divine name and holy baptism. In other words, it is precisely in our individual baptisms throughout history that this eschatological sealing is dramatized in Revelation 7 as taking place. Therefore, this vision depicts inaugurated eschatology as the mark of end-time deliverance is given to people in time, whether it be in past baptisms or whether it be in our present or whether it be in the future as people are baptized. Second, the activity of Satan depicted in Revelation 12 is primarily past and present and with some that is yet ongoing. It is clear that this scene is describing the past birth of the Messiah from Israel, the past expulsion of Satan from heaven, and the past and ongoing persecution of the new Israel. And that's text 13. I won't spend much time on that. This type of past historical material certainly is not unheard of in visions in other Jewish apocalypses. One prominent example of a Jewish apocalypse that does something like this would be the animal apocalypse or dream visions of 1st Enoch 83 to 90, which depicts past historical reality in the context of a vision. It often forms a legitimating foundation for a discussion of the future events that follow. The reader identifies what these events are because he connects them up with things that have happened in the past, and that transitions then into the events that are described as being future. As we move to the visions of the harlot of Babylon, the judgment of Satan, and the New Jerusalem, most interpreters are confident that these depictions are speaking about future end time or even the last day. That indeed is true, but with some exceptions. Revelation depicts Satan's defeat in three stages. He's thrown out of heaven, chapter 12. He's bound for 1,000 years, chapter 20. And after a brief last fling, thrown into the lake of fire. Unless you have become a premillennialist, it's clear that Revelation 20, 1-4, depicts inaugurated eschatology, something that's already happened. The binding of Satan although certainly this Revelation 20 text is very difficult, other portions of the New Testament point to Satan being bound in the past, in the life, the death, and resurrection of Christ. Christ himself said, how can one enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man? It's important to remember that this image does not mean that Satan is without power, but that his power is limited or restricted. Nevertheless, the point is made, even here in the closing chapters of Revelation, you're talking about something that is already a past and present reality. Skipping to the next section and final section, I don't have this titled on the outline, the relationship between worship and inaugurated eschatology. As we've alluded to above, there is significant and intriguing relationship between worship and eschatology in Revelation. Before examining this relationship, it's important to emphasize again the prominence of worship in Revelation. Not only do we find a vision of it in the throne room scene of 4 and 5, but also in the portrait of the innumerable saints in the latter part of chapter 7. After the seventh trumpet, we have another worship scene. It's 11, closing verses of chapter 11. After the victory of Michael in chapter 12, before and during the pouring out of the seven bowls in chapters 15 and 16, and certainly also after the judgment of the Whore of Babylon in chapter 19. In all of those scenes, there is the erupting forth of worship and song. Therefore, even as the apocalypse is revealing what was, what is, and is to come on earth, it is also consistently revealing what is present in heaven in order that that reality that has been seen, is seen, or will be seen, can always be interpreted in light of the reality of heaven. Rather than worship being an escape from reality, Revelation presents worship as the experience which truly defines all of reality. Leonard Thompson states, and I also have this volume listed with the on the back of your outline, worship establishes what is truly real, and therefore what is true. The presence of the Lamb beside the throne is revealed in the seer's vision, a disclosed mystery, but it is no less real and true because it is known through revealed knowledge. True worship reveals the way things really are. This insight is foundational for what follows. The worship depicted in Revelation establishes and defines reality for its hearers and readers. The reason this is true is because worship in Revelation centers our perception of reality on the divine presence, the throne, and the victory of the Lamb. If we look at the cosmos without seeing God and the Lamb on the throne, we are not seeing all of reality, certainly from the perspective of this book, especially the most important and determinative part of reality. Thompson, in his chapter on worship and Revelation, unpacks this relationship further. He states, the seer links worship and eschatology in two ways. First, eschatological drama has its setting in heavenly worship. And secondly, heavenly worship celebrates in the present the dramatic finale of the eschatological narrative. Three points I'd like to make. First, Thompson rightly observes that the eschatology of Revelation is set in the context of heavenly worship. However, he does not ask the question why. Because, and I'd like to answer it, because worship is centered in the presence of the Creator and Redeemer on the throne who acts and controls all history. The Lamb receives and breaks the seals on the book. He determines and defines the future due to his victory accomplished through faithful martyrdom on the cross. Second, Thompson states that heavenly worship celebrates the end of time victory in the present. Temporal aspects of reality are transcended in worship, at least in worship as depicted in Revelation. The past victory of the cross, as well as the future deliverance, are both part of the reality presented in the now of heavenly worship. Third, The worship depicted in Revelation also transcends spatial reality. The unseen heaven and visible earth are not two separate realities, distinct as in a Platonic universe, but are joined and experienced in worship. The worshipers in the great throne room scene of chapter 5 include all of creation, those in heaven and on earth and under the earth and upon the seas. Now, time is upon us. Last year I made some comments about the relationship then of this text with the Lord's Supper. And I think there's some very interesting connections in terms of how this text was not only one that was delivered so that people could share. David Awney has talked about how the apocalypse, the actual text, functions in a very similar way to the original experience, so that the readers have the visionary experience that John saw. As they hear it, they participate in it. And Leonard Thompson tends to emphasize how then the book was used in early Christian communities to share in this experience. I'd like to take that one step further. I think the real genius of the apocalypse is that it helped worshipers participating in the divine service to understand what was happening. As they celebrated, for example, the Eucharist, as they were receiving the Lamb of God, to understand that they were in the presence of God, to understand they were joining in the heavenly throne room scene, to understand that they were participating in the eschatological victory, the book of Revelation helps people in processing that. To cut to the chase, in contrast to the interpretations that stress the future nature of many of the visions of Revelation, this paper has demonstrated, or at least attempted to, that the dominant content of Revelation is the revealing of present reality for the author, a reality that is ongoing and present also for the church now, especially in the worship context of the divine service. Revelation certainly also contains visions of what lay ahead for the church in history and at the end of time. Yet all of these visions were given in light of the eschatological victory already won by the Lamb, in order that the church could celebrate also the future eschatological judgment and final deliverance in the here and now of worship. This is a reality that needs to be proclaimed as the church enters the uncertainties of a new millennium. Y2K was a non-event, but sin will continue to wreak havoc. God will continue his judgment. The faithful will continue to be persecuted and die in whatever time is left before the end. In the divine service, we participate in reality that is just as real as these tragic things, and even more definitive for our lives. The presence of God, the Lamb enthroned and in control, heaven, the saints, life, victory. May we use this apocalypse of what is present now to empower the church to pray boldly and confidently, "Come, come, Lord Jesus." Thank you.